sound of your city for 30 years.
CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, and with me is Phil Conlon. How are you, Phil?
Good afternoon, Phil. I'm doing well.
Phil has a show each Wednesday, Classical Underground, 6 to 8 p.m. And by the way, Phil, they're going to be asking you. There's an article today's New York Times saying that they played Beethoven's Ode to Joy at the end of the G20. And the New York Times has devoted a whole piece to trying to figure out whether that was a good idea and what was the true message. So maybe Wednesday you can we'll leave people to
wonder. I'll give you a hint. I would say that even the greatest works of art can be reduced to a meaningless cliches if you abuse them long enough and often enough. And the Ode to Joy is certainly at the front of that parade.
All right. There'll be more on that Wednesdays 6 to 8. Today we're going to speak to Stephen Sahuni in Latakia, Syria, and then we will be talking to Zafar Bengash, crescent-international.org, and they are going to have a meeting this coming Saturday, and Lord Abu, do you have his name there, Phil?
I certainly do. Lord Nazir Ahmed.
Nazir Ahmed is coming.
The first Muslim member of the British House of Lords and founder and past chair of the All Parties Parliamentary Committee on Kashmir.
We'll be talking to Zafar about the significance of this because it'll also include the matter of it's focused on Kashmir, a topic that is not talked about, but it involves many millions of people and two nuclear-armed states, Pakistan and India. The U.S. doesn't have a problem with them, and that leads us to our third guest, who is going to be Steve Gowans. And this is one of the points that Gowans wishes to talk about. He has written a new article about the, I guess we can't avoid the word crisis, involving North Korea. And so he's going to explain how that might be resolved. So those will be our guests. And I think we
can. You hear me?
We can. Can you hear us? Do you have? Can you hear us, Stephen?
Phil.
Yep, he's trying to speak to us. Let's hope he says everything he says is perfectly clean. Can you hear me, Stephen?
Phil.
Hello. Well, we'll have to try again, and we'll try to get Stephen on the line. You can see that it's a real effort here. It's an art form. By the way, we're talking, but remember that we hope to be speaking to a reporter who is in Syria and who gives us an on-the-ground picture of what's taking place there. Very much to be desired. Almost all the commentary in our part of the neck of the woods is done by people who have no context inside Syria. And they rationalize that by just smearing the government of Syria, calling it names, and that satisfies them that they've done their duty. And they don't have to know the facts or talk to anybody real. By the way, you'll find an excellent article on it, Moon of Alabama. Phil, do you go to that site?
I do, yes.
Smart people, yeah. The guys who write Moon of Alabama. And they're talking about Max Blumenthal. Is it Blumenthal?
Yes.
Yeah. Now Max has been doing recently a lot of good work, and I take my hat off to him. However, Moon of Alabama is pointing out that he is being very critical of the mainstream media for their lack of objectivity on Syria. Good point. It would be a stronger point if he reminded them that he used to do the same thing, and Moon of Alabama documents it. And by the way, this isn't a matter, in my view, showing somebody up. But it just, for the record, when you want to respect a journalist, it does help if they say, by the way, I got it wrong myself. And it's kind of important because there is a great journalist. Her name is Sharmeen Narwaneh. She lives, I believe, in Lebanon. She's a brilliant journalist. And she and Max Blumenthal wrote for the same journal. I think it's Masdar News, I believe. And at the beginning of the conflict, I'm going to call it that, like the Korean War, it's a conflict, Charmaine took the view that the fighters were foreign inspired and armed right away. That was her analysis. Blumenthal attacked her, and he resigned. He wrote a public letter why he was quitting, because Charmaine had the wrong view of the democratic rebellion. That was how he was painting it. And so now, you know, it might help. I mean, Charmaine is qualified, and indeed the evidence is better qualified than he is. And just a mere mention that probably he jumped the gun. And maybe it would help us if he would explain how this happens. And it happens, frankly, due to ideological and informational hegemony, which comes from here. And the Pentagon, very often in their little reports to one another, talk about it. They say that whenever they undertake an operation, the first thing they wish they make sure they have is information domination and across the globe. Everywhere they can, they make sure that the morning news and the afternoon news and the commentary is flowing their direction. So it takes a Charmaine Nawani to stand up to it.
By the way, Phil, later on we'll be talking to Stephen Gowans about North Korea, and there's one of the best examples of it. None of these Western journalists have any sources inside North Korea. They don't go there. They never interview the North Korean government, and yet somehow they've got all the information about how terrible a place it is.
Well, exactly. And it's all caricature. The evidence, allegedly, the leader is, you know, they always characterize him as a madman, when actually Washington, there's consensus is the leader is a madman. Now, maybe that's not even right, but in the case of North Korea, anybody who looks at it soberly says they're doing what is, from their vantage point, perfectly rational. They've been threatened by a superpower and being told that they have to change their form of government and the leadership. They're told that. So if they're not... Do we have the other guests? Oh, I would think it in about 10 minutes. Yeah. Actually, well, now that we're producing on air, we could go in 5 minutes, actually. because I'm remembering now who our other guests are. So at any rate, yes, the buying into what is produced here, I mean, it's very hard to resist it. And by the way, Max Blumenthal, remember who he is. He's the son of a man who was one of Clinton's key people. And he went through, his father went through quite a nightmare in the White House, brought on by Christopher Hitchens. This is an elaborate story, but here he is. He's one of the best people. And again, I congratulate him. Good for you. However, it is, his argument would be stronger if he would say, you know, look, anybody can make a mistake. By the way, he could be charitable to it. He could say, I used to say the very same thing, and here's why I changed. If you were in the conversion business, that would be the better way to convert somebody, to say, I was like you. You know, that's, by the way, Billy Graham used to open all of his big things about, he was the biggest sinner to ever hit the street. And I forget what he did. He's probably like me, stole watermelons. And this is a big deal. And his soul was right on the brink of hell. But he was rescued by the gospel. But it does help if you at least don't take the stance that you're, superior to the other guy. Now, there's another matter before. I think we're probably going to be speaking to Zafar. That's been my guess. And we really apologize for not being able to reach Mr. Sahuni. If we do, we will share him with you, promise. There's an article I urge everybody to read. It's Sunday, July 9, Toronto Star. It is by Sean Carlton. Sean Carlton is assistant professor in Department of General Education, Mount Royal University, Calgary. Treaty 7, he said. That's an interesting address. He studies and has published articles on the history of colonialism, capitalism, and schooling, including Indian residential schools. The key thing that here is the title of his article, which is John A. MacDonald was the real architect of residential schools. And he has this paragraph, and everyone should hear this paragraph and think about it. He's speaking of MacDonald's role. As Canada's founding prime minister, played the instrumental role of initiating, supporting, and defending the residential school system in the late 19th century. It was MacDonald, not Langevin, who served as the Superintendent General of Indian Affairs and was responsible for overseeing the establishment of residential schooling. It seems, though, that Langevin, as a lesser-known figure, is taking the fall. Taking the fall, Langevin. Everybody feels all so good about themselves. Oh, we've got, you know, the bad guy, and it's Mr. Langevin. Second quote that you should hear, because everybody's now being taught that Langevin's called Native Canadians a dirty name. So here's what he says. In May 1883, 2 weeks before Langevin delivered his infamous speech, MacDonald laid out the aim of the schools in the House of Commons. He argued, quotes, "When the school is on the reserve, the child lives with its parents, who are savages. He is surrounded by savages, and though he may learn to read and write, his habits and training and mode of thought are Indian. He is simply a savage who can read and write. The Indian children should be withdrawn as much as possible from the parental influence, and the only way to do that would be to put them in central training industrial schools where they will acquire the habits and modes of thought of white men." Close quotes. So people don't want to have the name Langevin. They don't want the name Langevin in Calgary. We got John A. MacDonald standing in front of Queen's Park. Something should be done about this. I mean, there's no way that Langevin should take the fall for John A.'s policies. Anyway, that's our little comment on that.